Hello, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we explore and analyze who and what have been making news at Iowa's state capital, including the governor, lawmakers, and legislation that's in the works or could be in the works, and what it means for all of us. I'm Dennis Hart, and I'm joined, as always, by Laura Bellin of the must-read political blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, here we are once again on Capital Week, and as always, it is good to be with you.
Yes, nice to be with you too, Dennis.
Well, Laura, we'd better catch our breath already here. What a week it was in the legislature last week. We're going to try to summarize this, and there was a lot going on. They wrapped up the year's session last week by passing just a flurry of bills. The House and Senate passed a major tax bill that's going to cut income and property taxes, realign the state system for funding mental health services, and boost tax credits for housing and child care. A whole lot to unpack with all this. The bill deals with 28 different subjects. Laura, I know you know every one of them. Let's start with the bill removing so-called triggers from a 2018 income tax bill. The result's going to be hundreds of millions of dollars in reduction of state income taxes.
Yes, they estimate about a $1 billion reduction in tax revenue over the next 8 years. And some of those are going to be accelerating. Some of them are going to take effect immediately, and then some of them will be building up. So there are some income tax cuts that take effect right away. They don't have to wait. The triggers were certain state revenue targets that would have had to be hit. So we're not going to wait for those. They're going to implement those income tax cuts right away. Also, they are phasing out the inheritance tax, as we discussed a few weeks ago. The House Republicans wanted a little bit of a slower phase out on that, but it is going to be completely gone, and that eventually when it's gone, that'll be about a $90 to $100 million revenue reduction per year. But really, the biggest change in that tax bill was moving the mental health funding away from local property taxes and putting it into a state appropriation. And there, the feeling is very mixed on this. Some of the people in the mental health advocacy community are excited because they feel like there's going to be a dedicated state appropriation, and others are apprehensive that the state may not always keep its promise to fund this line item adequately.
So now that the state's going to fund this, what does this mean for county property taxes?
Well, the Iowa House and Senate Republicans are saying that it's going to mean a reduction in property taxes because the counties will no longer have to levy this property tax for mental health. But it's a little bit unclear because they also eliminated what's called the backfill. This is state support for counties and cities that has been going on since 2013 when the legislators passed a very large commercial property tax cut. And at that time, they said that they would make up the difference, the revenue losses from that commercial property tax cut, they would make up to local governments. And that is now going away. So that's a concern that if you're, on the one hand, taking away the burden of funding mental health, but on the other hand, taking away this backfill, the county governments, I mean, they could lose in collectively, they could lose about $150 million a year. So they may just turn around and increase local property taxes to make up for that loss of state revenue.
So given that next year is an election year with the governor up for reelection, all in all, this is, in terms of the tax cuts, a pretty major help for her reelection, isn't it?
Absolutely. This is going to be a big theme of her campaign. In her 2018 campaign, the tax cut that they passed in the spring of that year, that was a major theme. And now some of that, some parts of that bill are going into effect now because of taking away the trigger. So that's going to be a big selling point for her. Also, the governor has been asking for this shift in mental health funding. And I don't know if next year will be early enough to see whether it's actually working, or too early, rather, to see how well that's working for funding mental health. But certainly that's going to be a theme of her campaign as well.
And it's going to be tough for Democrats to campaign against that, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think so. You know, on the other hand, if a bunch of local governments just turn around and raise people's property taxes, then the Democrats will be able to say, look, it's just a shell game where they claim that they cut your taxes in one way, but they're raising your taxes in another way. And there are pieces of this bill that it's not clear how it will play out. But for instance, there's a fund where they're going to be freezing property taxes for people over 70 years old, but then they didn't allocate state funding for the counties to cover that. So what may end up happening is that counties may end up shifting the property tax burden to younger taxpayers. So that might not be helpful electorally for Republicans. And just generally, I mean, there was a big shift after this 2013 commercial property tax cut, a shift away from the large companies like Walmart, McDonald's, a shift to property tax revenue coming from those corporate sources and more shifting toward residential property taxes. So I think that whoever ends up being the Democratic nominee for governor is probably going to claim that these tax cuts aren't what they seem. The income tax cuts predominantly go to the wealthier people, and then the property taxes are more of a shift than a real cut. So we'll have more information by next summer, I would guess, on how all of this is playing out.
Now, that same bill also phases out the state's inheritance tax by 20% a year over several years. Let's talk about that.
Well, the inheritance tax works differently from the federal estate tax. The inheritance tax is paid by the people who inherit the money, as opposed to the estate tax, which would be taxed on the estate before it goes to any heirs. And Iowa had already eliminated the inheritance tax for direct descendants. So children, grandchildren, or conversely, parents didn't pay any inheritance tax already. So it was something that was only levied on some extended family or friends. There are people didn't have children and wanted to leave their property to other people they were close to. Those were the people who were paying the inheritance tax. And that's why a lot of Democrats in the Iowa Senate, actually, all the Democrats voted for the bill that phased out the inheritance tax, because they felt that the way it currently operates is a little bit unfair to people who are in non-traditional family units, especially in the LGBTQ community. There are a lot of people who end up having to pay inheritance tax on money they inherit from close friends if there is not a familial relationship. So, but it is going to be a significant revenue loss. I mean, $90 to $100 million a year once it's completely phased out in around 2024 or 2025. And of course, that's money that can't be spent on other priorities that Democrats want, like the education.
Right. Well, Republican lawmakers did some other things besides cut taxes last week. They took a major step in a years-long process to enshrine an amendment in the state constitution, and we've talked about this before, saying that the constitution does not secure a woman's right to an abortion. So let's talk about what happens next.
Well, right now, nothing happens until after the next election. If the Republicans control both chambers of the legislature after the 2022 election, they need to pass the same wording of this constitutional amendment again in both chambers, and then it will go on a statewide ballot for Iowans to decide whether they want to add that language to the Constitution. And there was a lot of debate. I mean, when they debated it in January in the Iowa House, and the debate was a very similar last week when it came back again, where the Republicans saying this is too counteract a judicial power grab and overreach by the Iowa Supreme Court in 2018 when they enshrined a constitutional right that doesn't exist. And then the Democrats said, look, what you're really doing is saying that no woman has any right to an abortion under any circumstances, not in cases of rape or incest, not if her life is in danger, and not if the baby has unsurvivable fetal anomalies. I mean, there just aren't any exceptions written into this constitutional amendment. But the Republicans altered the wording last week, and they seem to be confident that the way this is worded, this is going to be appealing to Iowa voters. As we talked about in March, if you may remember, the Des Moines Register's Iowa poll that's done by Seltzer and Company, they polled on whether people want to add a constitutional amendment on abortion to the Constitution, and it was overwhelming. It was only about a third of respondents supported that, and about 55% didn't support it. So that would not be very promising. But Republicans think that if they can frame this issue in terms of we're just trying to prevent public funding of abortion or abortion, late-term abortions up to the day of birth, that's what this amendment is about. They think that they can bring people around. And there are social conservatives who have done polling on this, and they claim — they didn't release the poll numbers to me, I asked to see them — but they claim that in their polling that this constitutional amendment is much more popular than the Des Moines Register poll would suggest.
Right. Okay, but nothing could appear on the ballot before 2024.
Well, probably this is — I've been looking into this, because normally constitutional amendments go on the ballot at the same time as a general election. So normally it would happen in November 2024 general election. However, the legislature can set the date at a different time. There have been a couple of constitutional amendments that were put before Iowa voters to coincide with a statewide primary. And actually, they could do whatever they want. They could set a one day. They could say, you know, the second Tuesday in August, we're going to have a statewide vote just on this amendment if they want to. I don't think that that will happen, but I've heard speculation that they may try to schedule this vote at a time when there's lower turnout. So, for instance, they could theoretically schedule it to coincide with the November 2023 school board and city elections, which happen across the state. Now, that would be a break with precedent, but the Republican majorities have been breaking with precedent for a while. So
right.
We'll see.
Okay.
Most likely November 2024 is when the people of Iowa would vote on this amendment.
We'll be around. We'll talk about it. Meanwhile, lawmakers in both chambers passed that Back the Blue policing bill that creates new penalties for protest-related crimes and gives qualified immunity to police officers. Democrats in both chambers objected to this. It's been sent to the governor. Well, let's talk about this one.
Well, there was a bit of late intrigue with that bill because, as you may remember, there were several different pieces of legislation that were floating around the House and Senate all year, and they finally wrapped it all up into one bill as part of this grand bargain. But one piece that didn't get in there was providing sick leave for officers. And so on the day that this was debated, I was hearing that actually the police groups were pulling their support from this bill. It didn't end up happening. At least the lobbyists didn't change how they were registered. But the law enforcement groups were very unhappy that sick leave provision didn't make it into the final version. That was something that the House Republicans wanted in there and the Senate Republicans didn't want it in there, presumably because that would be expensive for government. So it's funny that in a Back the Blue bill, the biggest priority item that the law enforcement wanted, which was more pay for sick leave, they didn't get. So that is something missing from the bill that I haven't heard a lot of discussion about. But yes, the bill, they left in basically everything cracking down on protest-related crimes. A lot of things that used to be misdemeanors are now felonies. Things like damaging property in the process of an unlawful assembly. I mean, that could be, you know, you would, in theory, it's supposed to be about things like spray painting statues or destroying, damaging police vehicles, but really it could be anything. And some of the Democrats were saying during the debate, somebody could trample on a flower bed in a public park and they could be charged with a felony. Now, we don't think that that's how it would be implemented, but that is how it could be implemented. And there are certain new wordings for things that are like obstructing the public way, obstructing a sidewalk. And it's just, it's the way it's drafted, it could be interpreted very broadly to crack down on a lot of things that people wouldn't consider unlawful protests. So that, I mean, I think that this summer, it's going to be interesting to see how the Black Lives Matter groups around the state react to that. I assume the governor will sign the bill. She hasn't signed it yet, but I do expect her to sign that bill. And we'll see whether that adjusts any of the protesters' behavior.
One of the things the governor wanted in this bill but didn't get it was a ban on racial profiling.
Yes. I mean, the governor said in her condition of the state speech in January that she wanted to combine these measures that she described as backing the blue with also steps to ban racial profiling, and nothing like that even got through a committee in the House or the Senate. So I don't know, you know, the governor didn't really seem to put a lot of muscle behind trying to get that when these late negotiations over different pieces of different bills. I never heard that the governor's legislative liaison was really working on getting that racial profiling language through. So I don't know how hard she really fought for it, but they did get the qualified immunity language in the bill. And I think that law and group enforcement groups will be happy with that because it means that if police do something that violates your constitutional rights, like an unlawful detention or injure you in the process of an arrest that shouldn't have been made, it's going to be a lot harder to sue police in the state of Iowa. There was an Iowa Supreme Court case in 2018. And Ken, this one was written by one of the conservative justices, actually, but it created a more favorable framework for these lawsuits against police than what the federal qualified immunity framework is. And what this law does, or the bill that the governor is presumably going to sign into law soon, is it codifies the federal concept of qualified immunity. So it's just going to be really hard for plaintiffs to prove that burden that the police officers shouldn't be protected by their immunity because they were performing the course of their official duties.
You know, we've talked about this before on this broadcast, but for first time listeners, I have brought up several times, and we've talked about it, the fact that the legislature, as its lesson it took from all the Black Lives Matter protests in Iowa and across the nation last year, they decided the best thing to do was to protect police.
Yes. And there really wasn't a lot of, I mean, in the debates in the House and Senate, the members of the legislature were really talking past each other. I mean, I just Right. didn't hear a lot of acknowledgement. The Republicans who were running these bills, there just wasn't a lot of acknowledgement about the real grievances that animated those protests. And State Representative Mary Wolf, who's a Democrat, represents the Clinton area, and she's also a defense attorney by trade. So she's represented a lot of people arrested for lots of different things. And she said, you know, the message of this bill is just sit down and shut up to people, and many of them young, not only young, but young idealistic people who are wanting to make the world a better place and fight injustice. And the message of the Iowa legislature is sit down and shut up.
Yep. It is 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin. This is KHOI Radio's Capital Week. We are here to talk about what in the world went on at the state capitol last week. We're here every week at this time. And boy, a lot went on at the state capitol last week.
Yes.
Among them, and this one made some news, and this one made controversial news across the state. Both the state house and senate, in a late night vote, voted to ban mask mandates in schools, cities, and counties. So leaders of state school districts were left to react. The governor signed it at 12:36 in the morning after it was signed. She had a rally to sign this thing. It went into effect immediately. To use the vernacular, it messed up many school districts. It messed up many towns in this state. Let's unpack all of this impact and why in the world it passed and why the governor signed it to go into effect immediately.
Well, Todd Dorman, who's a columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and before that, before he was a columnist, he was a political reporter. And before that, he was actually a clerk in the Iowa legislature as a young person. So he said he's been following Iowa legislative happenings for about 30 years. And he said he could never imagine a governor signing a bill in the middle of the night that takes effect immediately. So many people in the state. So this really popped up out of nowhere. And one theme that was running through this legislative session is a lot of major changes to bills that happened late in the game on the floor of the Iowa House and Senate. So there was no opportunity for public input. So it didn't go through the subcommittee and the committee process where people can have their say. And I started seeing comments on social media on Tuesday of last week that they were going to do something about this, about these mask mandates. And then on Wednesday, the language came out as an amendment to a broader education policy bill that had three parts of it. So one part is that schools cannot require staff, students, or members of the public who are on their property to wear face coverings under any circumstances. And Democrats tried to amend this to even specify the COVID-19 pandemic because there's a concern now that this is in the code. If there's some future pandemic, now it's in state law that schools are not going to be able to require that. And so that's one part of it. The other two parts relate to city governments and county governments. And they're worded, you know, they're drafted in an unusual way. And I was talking to some people who follow local government matters last week. And it's the intention of it is that cities and counties can't impose mask mandates. And almost all the cities in Iowa have already repealed. I think Ames is going to be repealing theirs tomorrow. But most cities that had mask mandates have already repealed them anyway. So I don't think that practically this has a lot of impact right now. But I think that the way it's worded might not actually do what the Republican legislators think it's doing. It says that the cities and counties can't require that private businesses enforce mask mandates, but it doesn't actually say that the cities and counties can't require individuals to wear masks. So I think that this is one thing that happens when language is rushed through and it doesn't go through a committee process. Sometimes there might be drafting errors, and that might be something that is in play here. Although practically, it wouldn't have much of an impact because right now there aren't any cities that have mask mandates in effect. And I think Johnson County is the only county that still has one, and that's going to be expiring soon.
So was this, in your impression, and you have followed the legislature for a while, was this an effort just to satisfy the Republican Trumpian base, which is anti-vaccine, anti-mask mandate, anti-government intervention? This whole pandemic is just it's fake. Was this just one of those efforts to do that, a last minute thing?
Yes, I think so. And I mean, the people who were gathered in the governor's office for this bill signing at 12:30 in the morning included people who are, they're very well known in the anti-mask, anti-vaccine community, but they're also well known in Ankeny for being promoters of the QAnon conspiracy theory, and they carry around placards. I mean, the governor, there were pictures taken of the governor signing their poster boards, and one of them says, unmask our children, hashtag stop the abuse. So it literally says wearing masks is like child abuse, and the governor signed this and posed for pictures with these women. So I think there was definitely a political pandering element to it, and school district leaders were really unhappy because even the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, he issued an executive order that was similar in intent to this, but he actually let the schools maintain their mask mandates through the end of the school year. So for the schools portion of it, his executive order only takes effect sometime in mid-June. So the governor actually went even further than the governor of Texas. And with only a week or two left in the school year, a lot of districts were not happy. And of course, a lot of parents. Now, I was up late, right? I mean, I'm up late anyway, especially on the last night of the legislative session. I never go to sleep. But most people, normal people, were asleep. And so thousands of Iowans got up and got their kids ready for school and sent their kids to school in masks. And then they didn't have a chance to have a conversation with them about what was going to happen. So it was very confusing. And a lot of people were posting on Thursday that there was a lot of confusion and even bullying in some schools, that kids who were, you know, triumphantly ripping other people's masks off and throwing them on the ground. So, you know, it really created a lot of problems. And teachers, there were some teachers who might be immunocompromised for whatever reason. Maybe they have some kind of condition. Maybe they've had a kidney transplant. Maybe they're being treated for cancer. And so now, you know, they have to have maskless children in their classrooms. And maybe they thought that they agreed to teach in person this year, but maybe they expected that their school district was going to require masks for everybody through the whole year. So, I mean, a lot of people were not happy about it. Of course, the people who never supported the COVID-19 mitigation policies anyway were ecstatic that these things are being lifted. Right. They said, you know, they said this is a victory for freedom.
Right. Well, speaking of the coronavirus, the governor also signed a bill last week that's going to withhold state grants and contracts from local governments or businesses that require customers to prove they received the coronavirus vaccine, the vaccine passports bill. So the legislature passed and the governor signed a bill to ban vaccine passports, though there was no move anywhere in the country to have vaccine passports.
Right. I mean, there was no government issuing vaccine passports. I have not heard of any Iowa business that was requiring customers to show that they were vaccinated. I mean, I think this was definitely a messaging bill. You know, some bills address problems and some bills create the appearance of addressing the problem. And that this was in that group. And the, as we discussed on a previous show, the anti-vaccine people actually didn't, they weren't happy with the bill because it exempted healthcare facilities. So hospitals and nursing homes primarily, they can require, now I have not heard of any hospitals or nursing homes requiring people to demonstrate that they're vaccinated. But in theory, they are exempt from that bill.
I don't think we even require vaccine passports to get on this broadcast, do we?
We do not. For the record, I am fully vaccinated. I'm pleased.
As I am too. And that's why we can get close to each other. I believe tonight we are within 1,800 miles of each other.
Yes.
We are social distancing. The governor also signed into law, that's kind of an inside joke. We should explain we're on Zoom right now, zooming through this hour. Laura is in the Midwest. I am on the West Coast, soon to be in the Midwest, though, so we'll be a lot closer. Okay. The governor also signed into law an expansion of the state's charter school program. There are two charter schools in Iowa right now. This creates a new way to form a charter school. Let's unpack that one.
Yes. Well, there are already several groups have said since last week that they're planning to apply for charter school status. So the existing law said you had to go through your local school board to get a charter school. Now people will be able to apply directly to the state board of education to get approval. And they don't all have to live in the community where the charter school is going to be operating. So it's likely Randy Richardson, who worked for the Iowa State Education Association for many years, and he keeps an eye on education policy bills and occasionally writes about them for my website. He says that he thinks it's likely that some of the national charter school chains will be coming to Iowa, groups like the KIPP Academy, Charter Schools USA, and Academica. These operate in many states. So There's going to be a two-step process for funding these. The state is going to be funding public school districts, and then the school districts are going to be transferring those dollars to the charter schools for all the students who are leaving to attend the charter school. So it's definitely going to siphon money away from the public school system. I mean, I doubt that most communities in Iowa are not going to have the population to support a charter school. So it's probably going to be in the larger urban counties where this happens.
So was the point of this bill just to jam it up public school systems?
Yes, I think so. And particularly the public school systems in the larger counties. So probably the Polk County, I would think the Ames School District maybe would also be affected, but the Polk County, maybe the Iowa City, maybe Quad Cities districts, the larger districts are going to be the ones where there may be a population base to support a charter school.
Okay. Governor Reynolds made a whole lot of news last week. And again, last week, she repeated her claim that President Biden is responsible for the humanitarian crisis on the nation's border with Mexico, repeated that the state is in no position, state of Iowa, to accept any of the children that are, in her words, in harm's way, because the state does not have the facilities to help those children. And she said, and I'm quoting now, it's not our problem, these children. This is the president's problem. What do we make of that?
Well, generally speaking, Iowa Republicans are hoping that this border crisis is an issue that will work for them going into the next election cycle. And the governor has been talking about it, but the members of Congress have been talking about it even more. So all of the Republicans who represent parts of Iowa in the U.S. House, Randy Feenstra, who's in the 4th District, that includes Story County, Boone County, in your listening area, Marionette Miller-Meeks, who represents much of Southeast Iowa, and Ashley Hinson, who represents Northeast Iowa. All of them at different times have gone down to the border and have done photo op type events with some border agents and talking about the crisis. And Ashley Hinson, I saw, actually just introduced a bill today that says that the taxpayers wouldn't have to fund Vice President Kamala Harris's travel until she goes down to the border to see the crisis herself. That's kind of like way outside the range of things that Congress would normally legislate on. But in any case, so this is something Republicans see this as a winning issue for them. And I saw this came up in a telephone town hall that Ashley Hinson did last week, 10 days ago or so. And somebody said, you know, well, why is this, you know, what about worrying about Iowa issues and not the border? And she said, you know, we're all border states. You know, every state is a border state now. So they're really trying to, they feel that some, I don't know if they have polling to support this, but they feel that this is a winning issue for them, making people think a lot about the border crisis and pinning the blame on Democrats for that. I mean, as many people have commented, the contrast between Governor Reynolds saying, not our problem, we can't help any children, and Governor Bob Ray, who probably many of your listeners are old enough to remember, welcoming refugees from Asia. I mean, that's something that so many Iowans are proud of, that legacy. And so it's a legacy that we're not continuing now.
Have you seen in the years you've been covering this legislature an agenda as conservative, as much pandering to the base of either party, Democrats or Republicans, as this year's legislature?
No, this legislature, I mean, they went further than Republicans, even some of the trifecta legislatures since 2017 and 2018. And some people have said you couldn't even really call it conservative because it's more Trumpian. Some of what they did was very Trump-like, and it isn't traditional, the business conservative or country club conservative Republican Party. Some of the bills that were priorities for those groups, they didn't get those through. The things like the cuts to state unemployment benefits or the limits on liability lawsuits. I mean, the traditional business interests that were the backbone of the Republican Party, they didn't get everything that they wanted this year. And the Pat Reinhard, who writes the Iowa Starting Line website, he had a piece up after they adjourned last week, and he said, you know, Iowa is now governed by right-wing internet memes. Because he said, if you follow what's going on in the legislature, so often whatever was going around social media and memes, whatever the outrage of the day was, whether it was Facebook supposedly censoring conservatives or whatever, then you would hear legislators bringing it up and introducing bills on it. So some of these things like restricting training, diversity training in schools, and restricting. I mean, it's not really conservative if you think that conservative government is more about local control and less of an less of a big state government imposing its will on localities. Then you can't really say that what this legislature did was conservative.
It is half past the hour, and normally on KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, Laura Bellin and I would be saying goodbye, but this is a special broadcast. We're going to be on a little bit longer because there's a lot to talk about with what the legislature did last week, plus some other things. So for the next few minutes, let's talk about what else happened. The legislature, we've said they wrapped it up last week, but wait, there could be more. Yes. The legislature could reconvene later this year. Let's talk about that.
Well, the biggest thing the legislature has to do in a year ending in one is adopt new political maps for the next decade based on the federal census. And of course, we don't have the census data. The pandemic fouled up a lot of things for the U.S. Census Bureau, and they are months behind schedule in getting that population data to the states. So normally in 2011, when I was writing on my website, I was covering the redistricting process pretty closely. They had a new plan submitted to the legislature on April 1st, and Governor Branstad by April 20th had already signed that thing into law. So the things were moving really quickly. We don't even have the data that can be used to draw the map, and that probably won't arrive until August. So sometime in August or September, the legislature, more likely than not, is going to come back to consider a nonpartisan plan drawn up by the Legislative Services Agency. Now, the special sessions are pretty rare in Iowa, and when they've happened, they've usually been just to pass one bill and get out of there. There was when Tom Vilsack was governor, there was a time when they needed to cover a budget shortfall, and they came back for a couple of hours, passed a bill, and were gone. So it could be that the special session is only limited to redistricting concerns, but that's not a requirement anywhere. The House and Senate leaders can bring any bill to the floor that they want to, anything that's eligible for debate, and they could even come up with a brand new bill if they want to. So some of the things that didn't pass during the session, they could come back during the special session, and we'll just have to see. I have not heard, they haven't been tipping their hands really on what they might bring to the fore besides redistricting.
We know that the governor wants a transgender bill. She did not get it. This could come up, couldn't it?
It could. Right now, it seems that they don't have the votes to pass this. Certainly, they don't seem to have the votes in the Iowa House. And the Iowa Senate didn't seem too excited about taking that up. So I don't know whether they have the votes there or not, or if it's just the leadership. The business lobbyists don't want this because similar bills in other states about transgender limits on sports, they've led to some boycotts. They led to the the Major League Baseball pulling the All-Star game out of Atlanta this year. And the business community just really doesn't want that as part of Iowa's public image. I heard from a lot of people that legislators were surprised when the governor pronounced in late April that she wanted a transgender sports bill. I mean, that had not been part of the discussions throughout the legislative session, and that what they were already in overtime at that point. So it wasn't something that they expected. The governor hadn't introduced a bill on it. The governor hadn't publicly endorsed any of the bills that had been introduced. The bills that were introduced didn't even get to the subcommittee stage. So I just right now, I don't think that there is a very high probability that that is going to happen.
Couple of quickies before our friend Mike Murphy joins us on this broadcast. Paul Trombino, the state's director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, announced he's going to leave his position 4 months after the governor appointed him. Why is this important?
Well, this was a big surprise. Paul Trombino was the head of the Department of Transportation for about 5 years when Terry Branstad was governor. But when Kim Reynolds brought him back in early 2019, she created a new position for him in her office called Chief Operating Officer. And he was very important in the state's COVID-19 response. He just seemed to have his hand in a lot of the different decisions. So whether it was the no-bid contract for the Test Iowa program for COVID-19 testing, he was also very involved in negotiating the deal with Workday Computer Systems, so to transfer the entire state government's human resources and accounting software onto Workday. That was also issued as a couple of no-bid contracts, and just a very influential person. So when the governor named him in January to replace the retiring head of the Homeland Security Director, I thought, wow, you know, this is a very important job tens of millions of dollars in federal COVID-19 relief runs through the Homeland Security Department. And this is going to be a loyalist of the governor who's going to be in this position. And she gave him a huge bonus of about $46,000 so that he wouldn't have to take a pay cut from the salary he was getting in the governor's office, because the Homeland Security Director's salary, there's a state cap on that under state law. But he was collecting well above that state cap with a bonus. So I really wasn't expecting him to be leaving. And it was all announced. It was late Thursday afternoon. The legislature finished up late Wednesday night, and it just seemed to come out of nowhere. So I spent a lot of my Friday trying to figure out what's been going on there. And I haven't cracked the code, but there was a kerfuffle last week with a late attempt to add to the infrastructure bill a $4.5 million earmark for Homeland Security that would have been for a no-bid contract to a private company. And some people felt that Paul Trombino might have had his hand in that, and perhaps others weren't happy about it. Now, the Homeland Security Agency told me over the weekend that the Director Trombino wasn't involved in trying to secure that earmark. But it was all very strange the way it popped up. And from what I know about the appropriations process, legislators don't just introduce an amendment with a multi-million dollar appropriation without running it by the agency director or the agency's legislative liaison. I mean, they don't sort of come up with their own idea for, here, let me hand you several million dollars. So that was very strange. I mean, that the amendment was introduced on Tuesday. The wording was revised by the Iowa House so that it wouldn't go to this no-bid contract. And then on Wednesday, Paul Trombino was quoted in a news release by this company that possibly could benefit from this spending. And then on Thursday, they announced he was resigning. I mean, it's a very strange thing, and it was not expected given that he's been a trusted figure in the governor's office and he's very new in this job.
Let me be the first to point out that Laura Belin's use of the word kerfuffle is the first time that has ever been used on this broadcast. One more quickie. Democrat Dave Muhlbauer announced today that he's running for the U.S. Senate seat in Iowa held by Republican incumbent Chuck Grassley. Laura, who is Dave Muhlbauer, and why in the world is he running against Chuck Grassley?
Well, he's a former Crawford County supervisor. Crawford County is in western Iowa. It's just west of Carroll County. So it's probably just a little bit outside the KHOI listening area. He comes from a well-known political family in Crawford County. Both his father and his grandfather before him, they both served as county supervisor and then served in the Iowa House. And Dave Muhlbauer he served a term as county supervisor himself. He just fell barely short in the 2020 election of getting reelected. He was only a little less than 100 votes short. And this was in a county that Trump won by like a 2-1 margin. So fairly remarkable that a Democrat almost was reelected. So he's a fifth generation farmer, and he wants to go out there. He says that he's an old fashioned farmer, labor Democrat, and he wants to go out there and beat the drum and tell Iowans that Democrats haven't forgotten about rural communities, and Democrats have ideas for how to stand up for the little guy and how to break up some of the big monopolies that are making it hard for people in farming and in small towns. And so we'll see what happens. I mean, most of the field of people who are thinking about running for Senate are frozen in place right now, waiting for Chuck Grassley to make up his mind. So I think Dave Muhlbauer, I mean, he saw an opportunity to have the field to himself for a while. And I expect that it's eventually at least one other Democrat will be seeking the nomination. But probably for the better part of the next 4 or 5 months, he's going to be going around and he's going to be the only game in town. And I think it's an interesting message. I mean, he came out with a video with a lot of pictures. He's raising 3 kids on a farm in Crawford County, and just talking about the way of life, the rural way of life, and what Democratic values have to say about that. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch. Democrats in Iowa have tended to nominate a lot of candidates from Polk County, larger cities. And so there might be a lot of Democrats around the state who want to hear from somebody different, a voice from a different part of the state.
So down the road, in other words, it could be quite a kerfuffle.
It could be.
Yeah, this is about the time we need to bring in our good friend Mike Murphy. And for those who don't know, Mike puts us on the air these evenings and these afternoons for Capital Week. He puts local talk on the air 5 days a week. He is an engineer extraordinaire. He has many more talents than that. And Mike is joining us for the last part of this Capital Week. Mike, come on in.
Well, so great to be a part of this Capital Week broadcast. It's fascinating for me. being new to Iowa and getting this you know, intravenous feed of information right into my veins. And I was thinking that the metaphor of, you know, drinking from a fire hose comes to mind. Like, there's a lot of stuff coming on and maybe I'll get some of it. And then as I was thinking about that, I was thinking, particularly you, Laura, you're drinking from a fire hose for many, many hours, and we're getting a 30-minute benefit of all that, where Dennis skillfully extracts information from you and questions that you have synthesized and distilled down to the essence from hours and hours and hours of stuff. I'm assuming that's true. I'm assuming.
Yes. Yeah. I really watched a lot of hours of legislative debate last week, and we didn't even get to the half of what they passed. I mean, they passed every budget bill in 2 days. So we'll have a lot to discuss in future weeks as well. But I just appreciate having an opportunity to discuss some of these things in depth. There aren't many places on the radio where people can talk in depth about state politics and state government.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, working with Laura here on these evenings and afternoons is a delight for me, because she is undoubtedly the most knowledgeable person on state legislative activities in Iowa. And you're absolutely right, Mike. I just sort of, you know, I toss out some ideas. We talk on the weekends about how the show might go on Mondays, and we just go from there. There is no script on this. Laura does not know the order in which I'm likely to ask these questions, and she is always prepared. And I can tell you, she's not reading from notes. I'm watching her. She has this in her head, and it's remarkable. Laura, you are a remarkable person.
Thank you. Mike, I do. I mean, I've immersed myself in the legislative happenings for a long time. And like I said, I watch a lot of the debate, and so I absorb quite a bit. So it helps me to be prepared for our conversations.
I'm not sure you've ever been talked about as a fire hose, though. I'm just not sure about that one.
but it is. I mean, we're taking all that information in rapid form over a half hour, but I just can't help to think that all the effort that goes into, you know, there's a lot more. I mean, I imagine sometimes you know, maybe on a Tuesday you're seeing something and thinking, oh, we're definitely talking about this next week. And by the time next week comes around, that's so, you know, it's been, you know, outshone by something else.
There's really a lot going on, and we haven't even talked about what Congress was doing last week, but they were also very busy. So there's always a lot to juggle and keep track of.
It is. And the purpose that the reason I'm involved in this conversation right now is not because of my knowledge of Iowa politics. Everything I know about Iowa politics, I know from these two. But but I do know the importance of community radio, and a fantastic program like this that really drills down and lays things out, it only happens with community support. The programming like this isn't used to sell shaving cream or something like that on a community radio station. All we're here is offering knowledge, offering information from the community. But it takes money to run this little old community radio station. And that's where I'm asking you, the listener, to come in and maybe go to khoifm.org and click on that yellow Become a Member donor button. It's very important. And that's the only way community radio happens is with community support. So please go to khoifm.org, and if you value this kind of program as much as I do, and I really do. Now, Dennis, you have been involved in news throughout the country on both coasts, and I'm curious, did you have a favorite news town in terms of where the news was the most interesting?
Well, it was interesting in every city. In Los Angeles, the issues were immense because of the city's homeless population and its heterogeneous population. San Francisco, a tremendous homeless population amidst immense riches. And it's one of the most diverse cities in the country. We have worked in Atlanta, I covered the Democratic National Convention down there. A remarkably dynamic city in an area surrounded by an area that is in many ways quite conservative. I'll just say quite conservative. And Atlanta was not that. Detroit had its own problems, a dying industrial city.
Yes.
Trying to survive the loss of the auto industry. Mm. And the city was hollowed out when I was there downtown. Mm. There was crime that was immense. In fact, I remember, and being from California, it was shocking to see some of the crime in Detroit. I remember one Monday morning, the Detroit Free Press newspaper, a lead story saying it was a quiet weekend in Detroit. Only 7 people were murdered.
Wow.
For California, guys like me and gals like, you know, my wife, it was rather shocking. So every city has its challenges. It has its immense opportunities and cultural events, et cetera. And I've just been so fortunate over my life, and I've unfortunately lived a long time. I mean, I want to continue living, but it's been a long time. I'm a kind of an older guy.
Yeah,
to
yeah.
have been able to go across the country a couple of times, several times, to different cities and cover all the news stories, the elections, the crime, the city councils, the board of supervisors. I feel immensely lucky to have had the experiences I've had. And when we decided, my wife and I, to buy a place in Ames years ago, because we had worked, I had taught at Iowa State University in the Department of Journalism, and we wanted to come back to Ames. It was the finest city we'd ever lived in, and spend at least our summers there, at least that. It was a no-brainer. And we have always enjoyed coming back. We are coming back again in the next week and a half to spend the summer there. I love walking the streets of Ames. I love walking through Old Town. We live in Old Town. And it's a delightful change of pace for us. And so I feel fortunate to be here on KHOI. I offered my services to Ursula several years ago. And she wisely or unwisely took me up on it. Probably unwisely.
No, that was a good move. It was for sure a good move.
But I love doing the news on Monday and Friday mornings on Local Talk, and I particularly love this broadcast, which is live on Mondays, replayed on Wednesdays, because Laura and I literally do not know what we're going to say, only an outline that we've talked about on Saturdays, but it's all ad lib, and it comes out, I think, pretty darn well because of the lady who is on the other end of this Zoom call, Laura, who knows, as I say, an immense amount about Iowa politics. I follow it on a daily basis through numerous news media sources, but Laura's there, and she looks at it, I think, 26/7. I think she operates 2 hours longer than the typical 24-hour day. Am I right, Laura?
Possibly. I'm fortunate I need less sleep than the average person. So it leaves a lot of hours to keep following the Iowa legislature, but it's always...
This is the first time I've ever known you to admit that you sleep.
Yeah, and we appreciate that you don't sleep during this time. Yeah, yeah. So we appreciate that you're still going.
Let me make a pitch, Mike, if I may, and I know Laura agrees with me, the value of KHOI Community Radio. And I say this not because we're on it. I say this because I've listened to radio all across the United States over 40 years, 50 years, and I've been in radio. This station is unique in that virtually every bit of programming is locally produced by people who are not radio professionals. They are people with intense interest in putting out a particular music broadcast, a particular talk show, whatever it is. And they do this on a volunteer basis. The money we're asking for, the donations, are not to pay these people. Laura and I get no money. And by the way, Laura and I, you would agree, we earn it.
Yeah.
No money.
I have a very token salary.
There you go. There you go. But it costs money to operate the equipment, to lease the rent the building. There are electricity bills. There are things that have to be paid for to keep it on the air. If you value what you heard tonight, if you value what you hear tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock, think about keeping it on the air. It takes people like you and me to keep this broadcast going because there are no commercials here, zero commercials. So the value of community radio is immense. And seriously, and this is not blowing Laura and my horn, there is nothing like this on commercial radio in the state of Iowa. I know of nothing like this.
No, absolutely not. And even, I mean, Iowa Public Radio has a lot of good programs, but the programming that I've heard on KHOI, it is different. And there are local voices being featured. There are voices we don't hear a lot from marginalized communities who are featured. And I think that people can discuss topics in more depth than what you get on commercial radio. And so there is immense value to the content that's going out on the air. And not just saying that because of this program, although I do really enjoy doing this program. It's fun for me. I haven't worked in radio before. So I worked for Radio Free Europe earlier in my career, but I wasn't on the radio broadcasting side of it. I was writing for their English language publications, which were mostly online. So this is a really fun experience for me. And I do hope that the listeners will step up and support the project because it's important to keep community voices going.
That's right. You can go to khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org and click on that yellow Become a Member donor button over on the left side. And it's very simple. It takes about $300 a day to run KHOI. So if you contribute at the $100 family membership level, well, then you're helping keep KHOI on the air for 8 hours. Every bit helps, so every bit helps. You know, one thing I do want to say, when I first came to KHOI, and it was probably the first time I heard Dennis delivering the news, I said to Ursula, man, when that guy's on the radio, it sounds like the news is on. And
you're very kind. You are very kind. I'm having a great deal of fun on KHOI, and I have for several years now. I particularly enjoy, you know, when the station's facilities are open, and they've been closed because of the coronavirus pandemic. But I have often hosted local talk, and this is before your time, Mike. Mm. And I've had a great deal of fun producing those broadcasts, bringing people in who have not been brought in on other radio stations in the Ames area. And Laura, certainly, the first time I met her, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, was the day after the election in 2020. Wow. When we went on the air and did an analysis of what happened in Iowa. And it was shortly after that, Laura, you'll recall, that Ursula said, could you guys do a half an hour show a week? And I think it took all of a second and a half for both of us to say, of course we could. Sure.
Yes. I mean, I never thought about, I wouldn't have even thought to pitch a show to Ursula, but it was great. I thought that it's fun for me just to occasionally call in and do a segment on local talk or other programs, but to have a whole half hour to really dig into some of these state government issues, it's a treat.
It is. And I think it's valuable to the public. And I also think, and I'm sure they hear this, that you and I have fun on this broadcast. It's a serious broadcast, but that doesn't mean we can't interject a few things to lighten it up because we enjoy working with each other. At least I enjoy working with you. I hope you enjoy working with me.
It is fun. I mean, I like talking politics. I could talk politics all day long.
Now, wait a minute. That could be a telethon that they want us to do down the road, Laura. And you talk 9 straight hours. I'm not sure we want to get into that one.
Oh, I'm sure Laura could do 9 hours standing on her head
But occasionally she might need a break to take care of personal things. And, you know, that just that could be a 5-minute thing down the road. And who knows? But, yeah, we take this show seriously, but we have fun. I guess that's the way to put it. This is a serious broadcast on serious issues affecting Iowans. And honestly, I don't know of any other place you can get this kind of broadcast.
Yeah,
no, I don't know many.
Yeah, I mean, you talked before about how a lot of us are unprofessionals, but you guys both are. You both bring professionalism to the table. And, you know, sometimes often, but as you said, we have a lot of people who are not professional. They're just your neighbors or whatever here. And, you know, it's often said the word amateur is often used derisively, but that really, I mean, it comes from the Latin ama. I mean, people who do it strictly for the love of what they're doing. And, you guys had obviously love what you're doing, but you add the icing on the cake is the level of professionalism that comes with it too. So you offer us the best of both worlds. And
go ahead, Mike.
I was just going to say, I know there's people listening who agree. They are listening, so they must enjoy what they're hearing. So please take some time and go to khoifm.org and make a contribution. We'd love to hear from you.
I was just going to add, and I know Laura will agree with this, if you like what you are hearing in this hour, normally it's a half an hour, if you like what you hear anytime during the course of a broadcast day, understand that this is not a typical radio station with a set format, the same music every hour or anything like that. It's diverse. And this is the only station where you can find that diversity. If you like anything you're hearing, please consider. Not for Laura or me. We get no money for this. And believe me, we don't want any for this. This is our joy in doing this. Do it for the station, to keep the radio station on the air with whatever it is you like about the radio station.
Yeah,
yes, and really it is the diversity of the voices. And it's something that you aren't going to find on commercial radio, where they're just looking for certain segments that appeal to certain types of demographics. And
right.
Maybe there might be controversial topics that wouldn't be discussed because they wouldn't want to alienate advertisers. And that's not going to be a factor on community radio.
And the diversity is, I mean, our schedule is like a rich patchwork quilt of
right.
all sorts of different programming. I often tell people, if you that community radio here in Central Iowa is much like the weather here in Central Iowa. If you don't like it, wait 15 minutes, and things will change maybe to your liking. But it's just wonderful that we're able to weave in all these great voices and including your own. We've got we're going to have 2021 Talks, our 3-minute news piece coming up in just 90 seconds. So I just want to remind listeners, go to khoifm.org and make that contribution, and I'll let you guys wrap up.
Well, Laura, what are we going to talk about next week? Briefly.
Oh, there's just a lot. I mean, they passed new restrictions on who can deliver absentee ballots. There's more education policy. There's a lot of pieces of the state budget that we didn't talk about. So we have no shortage to talk about. There's also going to be some congressional news as well. So I think we have no shortage of topics to fill our 30 minutes.
That's right. And you know what? I'm looking forward to it. And I hope you have, Laura, a great week.
Yes, you too.
You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio, and we thank you. Laura Bellin and I will be right back here in this very time slot next week, the very same slot, with a look at what makes news with the governor and with the Iowa State Legislature, and what it means for all of us. And you know what? It affects all of us. Until then, thank you so very, very much for the privilege of your time. We know you have other things you can be doing, and we hope you have a great week.